Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Oh, I wish I had a fancy pants pronunciation of my name.
Brian Brushwood.
There you go.
Sounds like the opening act for Celine Dion.
Brian Brushwood. He's going to eat fire for you.
So, gentlemen, I want to volunteer for a bold, ambitious experiment.
Okay. Wait, just you? You're leaving us behind?
I want one of you to volunteer. I will conduct the experiment.
Okay. I'm in.
All right, Brian's in.
Brian's in. All right, Justin, I want you to take this gun and shoot Brian in the chest. Here, do
okay.
it. Do it now.
Aha! Am I alive? Did I die?
Not yet, Brian. This is what the experiment's about. You are on the edge of death. Now, in order to save your life, we're going to take all of your blood out, suck it out like a horseshoe crab, and we're going to pump you full of saline. We're going to cool you down so we can slow down the death process, put you in what scientists are afraid to call, but we'll call it right here because we're not afraid, hibernation.
Yeah, suspended animation.
Yes, sir. We're going to suspended animate you. All right.
So it's like hibernation. So we just put him in a cave and give him some fish and a couple berries and stuff like that.
That's the recovery phase. For right now, what we're doing is we're draining his blood, we're chilling him down, popping him open. We got plenty of time, so like we can high five each other. We can look up stuff on Wikipedia, figure out what all those organs do. You know.
So I guess if first of all, wow, this is a real thing.
It's science fiction. This can't be done right now. I mean, that'd be stupid. I mean, to think that we could do this today, right now.
Well, okay, no, all right. Now you're burying the lead, which is, of course, I assume this is exactly what's happening, right?
Well, yeah.
So I guess the thinking behind this is that there are trauma victims where you got to do a lot of things and put a lot of bits in the right space extremely fast, where it's like they only have 15 minutes to live. And I guess the purpose of this, because the moment you say this, it made me think of in the early days of heart transplants and, you know, where they would make, what do they call it, artificial lungs or whatever that would take the blood out and oxygenate it and then pump it back in for when they're doing heart surgery. Like the Russians did it on the cheap. They would take bodies and pack them in butcher's ice and drop them down low enough that they would just do the heart transplant real fast and palpitate like they would just squeeze the heart with their hand to keep it going. And it worked. Like dropping everything down to that ridiculous low temperature bought them enough time that they could do extraordinarily horrifically complex surgeries in time without all that equipment. I assume this is the same kind of idea.
Well, it's going a step beyond because, we know that like chilling the body can help. But certainly, it slows metabolisms down. I think now what we're doing is like draining the blood out entirely so we can prevent certain kinds of cellular death in what's going on. And so like filling the body, pumping them full of saline when you chill it down, because there's been some extreme examples we have of people who've been like some cases like who've been like essentially like dead for hours, like packed in ice falls, etc., and then revived, which just the body of knowledge on this, which was just a fringe area, keeps increasing. And then we're like, you'd hear these anecdotal stories like, oh, they pulled this guy, he'd been under the ice for like 2 hours or whatever, and he was dead, and they revived him. You're like, that's impossible. But then you find out, no, actually, sometimes some weird process takes place on pigs that they lower their temperature. They found out that they can keep these things essentially in suspended animation for hours on end and go in and do these things. And if you try to do this on a human in real time, like normal body heat, etc., on the operating table, they'd die. You know, they just go, part would beat out, whatever, stop, and you just wouldn't revive them.
Now, and I guess the problem is on the cellular level, like obviously your cells don't breathe, but they require inputs and outputs of energy units or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, oxygen, et
cetera. Yeah, exactly. But I guess the idea is if you get your body down to 42 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, that the process by which all those cells do their chemical processing trick slows down enough to where what normally damage would start within, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. You get 3 or 4 hours because it's so slow.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly it. You're slowing down the cellular process itself. And what's really fascinating about this show is they've got this technique now that they want to do, and they don't want to call it suspended animation. Okay. Are they suspended? Are they not? Are you postponing the animation of this person? And you can stretch this out for hours, which is exciting. And where will this lead to? The research and body of knowledge we get from this is pretty amazing. So then the fun thing. So you have this process. You've done it on pigs. You do it on pigs. Nobody complains when you do it to a pig. Because the pig lobby just can't raise much of a fuss.
Right. They're too busy with the mass slaughter of their species for food element.
Yeah, every time they start like complaining, you knock over a garbage pan, you put some mud in a puddle, and you know, they're like, I'll get back to you. So, how do you go about testing this on humans? My suggestion of having Justin shoot you in the chest by some quarters could be considered unethical.
Yes.
I mean, but what if he signs a waiver?
At gunpoint.
Yeah. I mean, the gun's already out, right? Like, what am I going to do? Point it at the ceiling? That seems dangerous.
Well, and the waiver was out, too. What are you going to do? Defy Chekhov's waiver? If the waiver's there, it has to be signed.
So what they've done is that there's a thing called informed consent, and there are all these little areas of law as far as what you can do when you can try to do this procedure. So in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, hospitals is going to be trying this technique. And they've put out, basically what they said is, we're going to do it to people we think that we can't otherwise save. Like, there's just no option that we can save them. So then if we don't do anything, they die. If we do this, we might save them, which maybe is a little bit of a gray area. But just to let the public know, they took out ads in the newspaper, and not a single person has said they want to be opted out of this.
Oh, is that they're doing it as an opt-out thing? They're like, hey, yes. FYI, we're going to freeze some bodies. Raise your hand if you don't want it to be you. Nobody? Nobody? Okay. All right. We're going to freeze your bodies.
So I think it's a interesting way to do. Yes, technically you did new notification. Far be it for me to say who the most likely victim of a gunshot wound would be in Pittsburgh. I have a feeling they're not a subscriber.
In general, I feel like putting, because usually like those ads that are like required by law or the ones that like that need to go in there, like are also kind of buried, you know, at a certain point in the paper that very, very like even at their peak readership, people didn't read all the way through, you know, to the point where those ads go in unless they just went out and took out a full page. But that being said, I feel like the idea of this being the way of record to let everybody know that something is going wrong is long since outdated.
Well, yeah, and I guess going on more than going wrong. You know, in the chat, QNX Monkey asks, what about ice crystals forming in the cells when you're frozen? And that's a valid complaint for people who are like freezing their bodies after they're dead, hoping that their brains will be thawed out in the future. But I assume they're not actually freezing. They're just dropping to just above freezing, so that's not an issue, right?
Yeah, they're not turning into popsicles. And also, you know, part of what's interesting too is like part of the reason they put the you want to slow it down and prevent like the growth of crystals, et cetera, but not go to the point that you actually get that happening. And I think part of the reason they use the saline too inside the blood is I think that's super chilled, which is kind of cool because they're actually not just cooling you from the outside. They're cooling you from the inside.
I'll tell you what. Yeah. Have you ever had that experience of being cooled
of
from the inside?
Your blood taken out and saline replacing it?
Well, not so much saline.
The popsicle enema?
No. When I donated blood, you could get double credits if you let them remove the platelets using an Alex machine. And what they do in that is it because it gets twice the effective amount of blood. They take out a pint of your blood. They run it through a cyclotron. They remove all the platelets. And they pump back in the plasma. Now, the plasma has cooled to room temperature, which is 30 degrees cooler than your body. And then they're going to run out and pull out another pint afterwards. But they pump back in the plasma, and it's astonishing. You can feel, you know, you're just having a conversation with them, and this cold spreads all from your arm all the way up to your chest and then down your toes. And you just start shaking. You start convulsing, you know, because your whole body core temperature just dropped 2 degrees just like that. They throw a blanket on you. It's a trip, man.
Man, this seems like something that could be a problem that could be alleviated by a few 99-cent hand warmers.
Well, it's
why don't we just kind of keep a little, just maybe one of those little – like Sterno stoves, like just so we can just get a little bit of heat on where that
plasma it's not like it's so unpleasant that to be honest, it was kind of fascinating. It was more like a wow, this is really interesting as it was happening. It wasn't that unpleasant.
Yeah. Although, like, I think throwing the term convulsions in generally gives people the...
I guess that would be the word for it.
The heebie-jeebie.
Shivers that you can't stop, you know? You're just like, ooh, I'm so cold. That's a convulsion, isn't it?
Oh, no. Listen, I am not saying that your description was not correct. I'm just saying that if we were to have somebody on from, the Red Cross or something like that that takes blood, they would probably search for words that weren't convulsion when describing the process.
Yes, technically we need to call them fun tremors.
Yeah, love quake. This is an exciting step, though. So seeing where this is going to go to next, we have a lot of interesting research now as far as people being able to survive longer. And one of the ideas is that we get to the really, the end game goal is either you get some disease, you can't be treated, and we slow your metabolism down and we cool you down or essentially freeze you so we can treat it later, which is got an immense amount of potential. For people who want to roam through space as popsicles, that's potential. So it's an exciting development.
How big a trial is this? How many people are they doing it on? All comers for a while, or they have a limit on it? Just 10 people over did they say how long a period?
No, I don't know what the period is. I mean, I may have been there, but I just really didn't read that well.
So at some point, they just have these people that this would be the end of the line, theoretically. And they're like, okay, well, we'll try this because this would literally, we are out of all of our options and we are now cleared to test for 10 of these cases.
Right. But keep in mind, like, this isn't the kind of thing where they would do it for days at a time. You're looking at a window of like 4 hours. You're taking what would have been a 5 to 10 minute window before they die and extending it to a 4 hour window to maximize the amount of work you could do in a short amount of time.
And really increase their billable hours. That's what it's really about.
Exactly.
I'm gonna play the devil's advocate here. My only kind of, again, I think this is a great study, great research thing. But when they have that, like, you would otherwise die, and it's like, that becomes that sort of debatable kind of thing. And anecdotally, I've heard kind of scary stuff coming out of emergency surgery rooms and stuff where that decision isn't as concrete as it, we'd like to think it is.
Well, and think about this as well. Like, let's say you're a doctor who wants to believe that this treatment could work and save the day. You are going to find yourself in a split second decision, gauging not only, and again, we'd like to think that we could be dispassionate human beings that make completely logical decisions. But at some point, you're like, what is somebody who I can point to and say, yeah, this person would die, but also someone who I think I could make live through this technique or whatever? Somebody so far gone that, because obviously, if you only get 10 Freezum coupons, you don't want to waste one of your 10 coupons on the study on somebody who's definitely going to die no matter what.
Sure. And there's the, like with the organ donor stuff, is that, If you're a person that perhaps they don't have a lot of sympathy for, and you end up on the table and you're in that borderline kind of area, and they're like, well, if we quit now, that liver can go to some 9-year-old who needs it.
Oof. I mean, is that really a thing? That's because I thought that there was like double blind studies that are statistical analyses that said that there's no way to gauge on that. Or that there's no effect. Is that?
I encourage everybody who wants to be an organ donor, and put that on your driver's license. I encourage you to do that.
That's weird.
In a statement.
I mean, is there any statistical knowledge you have on that?
Or no, is that just statistical knowledge?
Okay. See, because I'm almost certain that there have been statistical studies that said that that's just grandma talk to be afraid of them not taking care of you.
Okay.
It's.
Let's get back to what we were talking about. So, they've taken great care to not say this is suspended animation, aside from the kind of science fiction-y way that people think about that concept. Is there any other medical reason why they would want to not call it that? Like, is it like just looked at as a crackpot crazy thing?
And it applies that, you know, this is a thing where it has, as Brian points out, you get a bigger window. You have it, you can increase the amount of time that you can operate on somebody and perform these procedures, but it's not an indefinite thing. And you don't want to create false hope in people. You don't want people who have terminal diseases, et cetera, to all of a sudden be inundating you with requests like freeze me for this, when it's, you know, a thing that works for certain kinds of procedures and not for others. And it's still in its early stages. And to try to call it that is to bring on a lot of pressure when you don't want it.
What are they calling it? Shemended shmamination.
Emergency preservation and resuscitation.
All right. That sounds technical.
Quote the surgeon, we are suspending life, but we don't like to call it suspended animation because it sounds like science fiction. A surgeon at the hospital who's leading the trial. So we call it emergency preservation and resuscitation.
You know, and I think this is this seems silly and kind of eye rolling, like, hey man, call a spade a spade. But you know, it's important from a branding perspective if you want people to get on board with it. Like, you know, Google's not going to call their vehicles, you know, rolling robots of death or whatever. They're gonna have some name that doesn't say that they're automated robot potential killing machines.
Well, except for the Boston Dynamics ones, like those are rolling robots of death.
They're turning down Defense Department contracts on that now.
Oh, really?
They're mm-hmm. turning down.
That's why I said, I understand they're not going to do military contracts now for that.
Oh, that's wonderful. And a crippling blow to the my vision of them being Cyberdyne systems.
You know, maybe it's wonderful. Maybe, you know, to the guy who's going to be put on the front line, it could have been replaced by a robot. It's not. I don't know.
Or maybe it's Google looking at those contracts and say, why would we sell to our competition?
But yeah, I believe that's the most recent thing I read about that. I could be mistaken, but that's what I heard. So, gentlemen.
Yeah.
There was a classic song that asked this question, who wants to live forever?
And the answer is all three of us, right?
Right. You know who else wants to live forever?
Johnny Depp in that Singularity movie coming out?
Yeah. You know who else wants to live forever?
Fame?
Fame did flat out state that. And that's it.
So we had an announcement where Google had said they're creating the company Calico, which is not going to be marketing a line of cats, but in fact is their focus on health, well-being, and really to extend lifespan, because you have a bunch of billionaires going, you know what I don't want to do?
Die.
Yeah, that would suck.
Well, unless you're Elon Musk, which says die on Earth, and I intend to make that happen.
Well, he's like, everybody else goes like, I'd like to die on Mars, not on the point of impact.
Yes.
So Google said that they've announced their startup Calico for doing that. Now entering into the game, Mr. Craig Venter, scientist extraordinaire, one of the guys who just really was one of the pioneers in mapping the human genome. Incredible biologist, has done a lot of just incredible leading edge technology, creating synthetic life, etc. He was the guy that when we were trying to map the human genome, genome project, he's like working for the government at the time. He's like, hey guys, I got a faster way. They're like, whoa, this is the government. We don't want a faster way. He's like, fine, I'll start my own company. And the government's like, you know what? We can't let this private company beat us. We need to join them. And so anyhow, so he's kind of a maverick. And so now he's announced his company, which is called Human Longevity Incorporated, which is going to be doing research into stem cells, genetics, and other areas of trying to prolong life. And he wants to make 100 the new 60.
I like it. I'd be down for my parents are in their 60s, and I love to look and feel like that when I'm 100. You know, it's so funny so interesting to me, the quality of life, the fact that the quality of life and the overall, you know, extension of life is happening so fast that we really don't even have a way to measure it because we're not aging fast enough to be able to watch it happen. You know, it's like the you know, it's that whole singularity thing where it's like so many people are working on it. The research is happening so quickly and the advances so quickly that that I think it's relatively safe to say that in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to continue to see more or less the same level of advancement, right?
You know, yeah. And what's interesting, too, is, you know, one way you can try to look at it is to say, okay, are professional athletes getting older? You know, are you having people who are staying in the game a bit longer than they would have before? Because that's a great way to say, you know, to see how are people who are really, you know, competing in a physical level staying. And you get, you know, the age of professional athletes, you're getting people who are older, you know, pitchers and quarterbacks who are, you know, you would have years ago would have retired. They have to say too, and they could be substantially older if it weren't for the fact that the younger athletes benefiting from all sorts of medical technology and training, et cetera, are becoming far more competitive than they were before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, and what's crazy is the trickle-down effect. Obviously, a lot of these technologies are important for high-end sports where there's millions of dollars on the line, but on the low end, you know, look at this whole movement towards studying the metrics of your own body, you know, with your Pebble and your MyFitnessPals and your MapMyRides and so on. I just now, and thanks, guys, for pushing back this an hour, I just went on a 33, I'm almost 40 years old, and I just went for a 33-mile bike ride in 2 hours, the whole time, like, watching my metrics and all this stuff. Like, there's a good chance that if I stay on my current diet and exercise kick, that at 40, I will be in the...
He could reach 0 pounds. And finally, we will have succeeded.
The idea that at 40, I could be in the best physical fitness of my entire life is extraordinary to me. And it's not the kind of thing I would have thought of when I was 20.
Oh, dude, I totally encourage. I used to joke when I was in my 20s, you know, like, because I didn't, you know, exercise a whole lot. And people were like, oh, you know, why, what do you think about working out? I said, listen, why be in the best health, you know, best shape of my life when I'm young? You know, why get to the top of the mountain and just look down and go, ah, it's only about, I figured I'd just wait till later on in life, then get in shape. But it means so much more.
That's actually not the most terrible thought I've ever heard. I kind of see the wisdom in that.
I understand. Yeah, you know, it's no, like,
I'm definitely, cause I'm more on the other end of like, man, I should really start working out. I'm starting to get out of that. Like, oh man, like it was really easy to be in shape kind of thing. But, it's fascinating to see kind of people get into the leading edge on this. So what is Vintner's like strategy? Like what is his company focusing on doing?
I think, you know, they're right now, as far as, and I'm not sure what their business plan is, but I think there probably would be a lot of money in telling people we can make you live longer. But using, you know, genomics and stem cell therapies to help people stay healthy and vibrant for as long as possible, I think that it's going to be looking for areas that you can see, you know, what's the low-hanging fruit? You know, what are the places where you can start to make some big leads? And one of the things is just really looking at the human genome and saying, you know, what, you know, we were designed to basically create the next version of ourselves. And once that next version of ourselves was viable, you know, evolution, nature had little use for us. And we've been pushing that envelope for a long time. And, you know, the concept of grandparents, you know, is something that's, you know, kind of new. And great, you know, great grandparents and being around like that, or the idea that we can, instead of having kids at 16 or 17 years old, you can have kids at 37 years old, and we've changed this thing dynamically to give us, you know, the ability to fulfill our lives in our own ways, which I think is a great thing. And so you have this gene, you know, these genes that you're programmed to do one thing, and now we want to go in and say, well, what can we change? You know, what are the defects in there that we can correct that don't all of a sudden say, time to die, you know, make us not be, you know, replicants in Blade Runner.
You know, and part of it, there's two angles on this. There's, first of all, you know, there's the mental side of things, the tricks that we figured out that people who stay engaged, who have things to do, tend to live a lot longer and tends to perform much better on cognitive tests. You have lower cases of Alzheimer and dementia for people who are busy doing stuff all the time. And then the physical side as well, you know, we figured out that, you know, there's some big things like think about this, man. In the entire history of mankind, all of medical science is basically 150 years old. Like, we didn't have germ theory until then. And that's astonishing. In essentially what next century will be one lifetime is the entire history of medical science. So right now, there are so many different things to look for. I like your phrase about the low-hanging fruit. in that finally we have ways to quantify so much more by breaking down the human genome. And of course, we have tracking information. We have all this metadata about how much everybody works out and what they do and what they eat. You know, we could tell these things now. And I think there's, in the next 5-10 years, these are the companies that are going to say, hey, out of everything we noticed that this food and this exercise seem to be the highest correlated with longevity or whatever, or something, and not even with food or exercise.
And I'll even add to it, Brian, too, is that, you know, we had the birth of sort of science-driven medicine. It's like, as you say, it's like 150 years ago, but put into practice, it's still in its infancy. And you talk to a lot of doctors, they are not scientists, and you look at things like, we were taught for the longest time salt's bad, and now we find out that the tie between salt and hypertension is essentially non-existent.
Yeah.
Saturated fats, these things that, like, even till you'll still see, oh, avoid these things, that we're now finding, no, the science isn't what we thought it would be. And it's, there's this still this dogma and this sort of the way that knowledge functions in that sphere in public health is I would say very much not science driven. It's still, it's authority driven, but not science based.
Well, and it's also story driven. You know, it's us, the meta narrative is that we're all looking for this magic pill. And there are plenty of people willing to sell magic pills that just don't happen to do anything. I fell into a rabbit hole and spent like 2 hours researching MSG and finding out that essentially there's zero link between MSG and anything. Like, just eat all the MSG you want. And
true
and
MSG, true MSG allergy is extremely rare. And if you have it, you really know it. You eat it and you get massive headache.
That's what I heard. But then I read one study that was a double-blinded test where they didn't know if they were getting the real MSG or not, and there was no correlation. Even people who said they had acute MSG allergy. That that's what the study said, which was amazing.
I'm willing to think that's a possibility. But I know there are some problems when they do some kinds of studies like that, is people who the self description is a problem of that, because I'm willing to think that could very well be the case. But I've found some other stuff where you have there can be sort of a very selection bias in the process when you have people who are self-identified. But I'm with you on that. It's another one of those things that we've made it out to be this bad guy when it's more of an authority figure saying this, then it carries way more traction than it should from being science-based. And, you know, a great pivotal moment, an argument to why it's good for us to, once you try to do this, to live longer, et cetera, is that when we finally discovered, you know, first, like, let's say penicillin, mm-hmm. or the discovery of germ theory, the realization here we had these predators, these things that killed us, that for millions of years we really had no defense against other than trying to, you know, general cleanliness, et cetera, that once they infected you, whatever, the best you could hope was your body might be able to rally or whatever, but in some cases you just couldn't. But through the discovery of antibiotics, we were able to extend the quality of life for billions of people.
You know, it's easy. One of the cliches nowadays is that internet culture has us all wrapped up in our own cocoons. We don't actually leave the house. We don't really go out and meet with our friends. And everyone acts like that's a bad thing. But from a disease theory moment, like, think about all the benefits. You know, 90%, 95% of all my interactions with you guys are virtual, either over the phone, over Skype, or whatever. And you guys are two of my very best friends in the entire world, and I virtually never see you face-to-face. Think as the world gets more to that, I mean, I think our friendship is just as powerful and strong and awesome as it ever was. And we don't have to increase.
You don't have to be coughed on by me.
Exactly. The disease vector is reduced. So if there is a super bug, it's more possible now to spread. I mean, I say that, but I don't know if that's true in bigger cities. But it occurs to me that some of the minimizing contact that was very difficult to do 100 years ago is extraordinarily easy to do now.
Complete side jag. It would be really awesome if when you got sick, you were able to kind of just like look at your phone and like in laser tag where it told you like who shot you. Like you were just able to know exactly. It's like, oh, that weird dude with the mustache on the subway. Awesome. Thanks for coughing.
You actually know there are studies right now trying to use Twitter and Google searches to identify outbreaks based on that kind of data.
I believe it. And I believe that in the same way, you know, the metadata tracking is phenomenal now. You know, Target has been using these algorithms that look at how your purchases change at a certain time and is able to tell that you're pregnant oftentimes even before you know. And so they'll, and in fact, there's one story where this guy just went nuts on Target saying, my daughter's 17 and you're sending her this baby stuff as if she's sexually promiscuous or whatever. Shame on you. And I'm going to sue you. And the manager's like, I'm so sorry. It's an automated system based on the purchase records or whatever. 2 months later, oopsie, daughter was definitely pregnant.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But and like you can tell that. And then, you know, if you have enough Google searches in, let's say, the Austin area, like, why does my pee burn?
Yeah. By the way, pro tip, always do all your medical searches in incognito mode.
Yeah.
So that way only Google knows.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. Real quick with the Ventnor thing. Where do you think stuff like stem cell and gene therapy kind of fits into the culture as we go forward? Is it, you know, plastic surgery where it's just like a way that we can kind of make ourselves, you know, better, you know, in terms of, you know, like, so it's not cosmetic, but it is not essential? Or is it just the future of medicine itself? Is it how, you know, you should really go to the doctor and get that gene therapy?
I think that, you know, it starts from a couple places. I think that, you know, the core thing that you want to do, and the core people who do longevity research say, they're adamant about explaining, we're into quality of life. If you can, you want to be a healthy 70 or a sickly 70, you know, and that's the core thing, is how do you make sure that you have, you know, a good heart? You know, how do you have, you know, good health in that regard? And then move outward from there.
It's sort of, we're just in the days of just the core fundamentals. Like, in some ways, you know, the golden age of medicine has really passed. You know, there was a good 50-year stretch where we were discovering amazing new miracle drugs every 20 minutes. And nowadays, I think, like, the number of registered new important drugs was like 20 or something stupid. But in other ways, when it comes to stuff like stem cell and gene therapy and monitoring and metrics and stuff, I think it's so early in that game that we don't even know how big those results are going to be. And it might be the kind of thing where all of a sudden at once, you know, you figure out a way to you know, make your own stem cells off of your own stuff and then punch it back into all the different parts of the body.
When we were doing the decoding the human genome, one of the things we hoped for outcomes, we'd have like a bunch of new drugs based upon treatments for that. And then we found out that this thing's really complicated, that the way the causes for things aren't just necessarily single causes. It can be a cascade effect. And it became an information problem. It became like, there are ways to address this and to create solutions, but it's really complicated because, you know, this is, the genome is massive, and it's not always like you can just fix this thing here and have it adjust there. And you find things you would think would be totally unrelated, which can control for that. We're now in a much more hopeful phase now that we have this information computationally that we can look at that. And that was an area of you know, medical science that very few people were capable of even trying to address or get into. You know, the number of biologists familiar with computational simulations and the kind of things you need to know and understand to be able to do these things are limited. And I don't know if there's been a dramatic increase of them now, but whereas a higher awareness of tools and people like, that's what Craig Venter's onto, that's what Google Calico's onto, and it's kind of like they have to start over because the institutions doing that research before were not into, you know, were established before the information age, really. So,
yeah.
Whole new world. All right, one more?
Yeah.
Ready?
Yeah!
So this came out a while ago, and I keep meaning to address this, and it's kind of one of those things that makes me go, oh, that's fascinating. And I want to see if there's an update
things
on this.
Things that make you go,
So a couple weeks ago, Cartoon Network announced that they're looking for new television shows.
That's not too weird. People are looking for new shows all the time, aren't they?
Yeah.
True. All right. You're right. It's not it.
You're like, well, I thought it was just weird. That's the whole story.
Well, there is one catch.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be delivered through an app. And they're looking to, they're saying later this year they're going to release it. It's going to be called Cartoon Network Anything, an app with 15-second videos, games, and other tiny chunks of entertainment.
Oh, wow. So this is just, this is Blipverts, the experience for kids. It's that 15-second, we talk about potato chip-sized media. This is like, single pieces of Rice Krispies sized media.
So 15 seconds.
Let's What is the demo that we are looking at for Cartoon Network? Like what are the ages that they are trying to reach?
I mean, they own Adult Swim, so I don't know specifically. I guess I could actually click on the New York Times article and find out. but I think that, you know, let's see. So 15-second videos. And
keep in mind, that's more than – that's almost three Vines, and Vines can be pretty funny. And, you know, you get in, get out, and make your quick point. I mean, at the very least, let's see. You could do a whole category of, like, essentially knock-knock joke style. You know, just get in, get out, tell the joke. You can do factoids. Could be another whole category of that. Get in, blow your mind with a quick tip, and then get out.
Yeah, I mean, their brand has been, you know, a couple different places. Like, some of the games, like Robot Unicorn Attack and Amateur Surgeon and stuff. So, but they're talking about, I think it's an exciting sort of goal for them. I think that it's an interesting way to go about this. I think this is brought about by Chris Waldron, Vice President of Cartoon Network Digital Media, said they consider it a micro network. But they're basically trying to say, hey, let's look at iPad apps or Android as a, you know, it's a delivery platform, and we can put an app in there. An app can be a delivery platform for a game, for a TV show, whatever. Let's try to create our own sort of medium of content. The idea of 15 seconds, as you pointed out, you know, Vine is an attempt at that. And I think Vine is sort of having a declining, you know, viewership post Instagram adding video.
Right.
It's an interesting space.
I think it's a smart thing for them to do, because it's like you come in. What I like about it is that it's a structurally, fundamentally different experience. This is not television. This is not internet television. This is not a game. This is something we've never seen before, as its own thing. Because especially the idea that it's a mixed media thing, that sometimes it's interactive, sometimes it's not. I think that's a cool idea, and it could be extremely. Again, it all boils down to the writing and the execution.
Well, I think you just hit it right on the head, talking about being a different media and that opening up to that point where you look on HBO. We've talked about True Detective. Mm-hmm. And have you finished it yet?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
So in True Detective, it's this great 8-hour story. It is a 7-hour, but it's an 8-episode story, like an 8-hour movie stretched over Sunday nights that you can watch all at once. But it's not regular broadcast television where it has to hit the same sort of points you do in an episode with breaks. It's not like regular cable television with no commercials, even where it's episodic in nature. It's an 8-hour story told that way. And you have on one end of the extreme, you have that, or you have, you know, on Netflix, you get, you know, Hemlock Grove or House of Cards or Orange is the New Black, all uploaded in one massive chunk. And here's going to the other end saying, well, we're on mobile devices, and that's the focus here. Is because it's on cell phones, because they're targeting apps that it's mobile, is that when we can get, if we only get a little bit of your attention, rather than try to make you watch this longer form content, let's take content that shrinks down to that. I can't wait to see what the examples are.
Yeah, QNX Monkey points out in the chat that there's already, apparently they were testing the idea by releasing 15-second clips of Rick and Morty episodes before they came out on Instagram. So if you go to instagram.com/Rick and Morty, you can – I haven't seen it, but apparently this is something they've been nibbling at.
But is Rick and Morty a 30-minute comedy show or 15-minute comedy show? Or?
It is, or I don't know if it's if it's like pieces of it or clips beforehand or maybe original content written for it that way.
Yeah, I'd be curious. Yeah, there's been a lot of people doing the – using Instagram and Vine to do chunks and to do teases of stuff that's coming up, which is, it's kind of an interesting medium in its own way.
Well, and you saw that, like the micro trailers, like, you know, we entered a world where the trailer to get you excited about the trailer for the next Avengers movie or whatever, they released a Vine to get you excited about the release of the trailer.
Yeah.
Whoa, hold on. QNX Monkey is saying it's a 25-minute comedy, but they released the full episode in 15-second chunks. That's odd.
It's few people have done that now where they're like, oh, we'll put the whole thing up there and break it down into these bits. So it's not the same.
But this is us just kind of we are all blind men grasping at the elephant and trying to figure out exactly what this is at this point, right?
Yes,
like,
yeah.
I mean, and we can agree that some ideas are dumber than others, but we're all just trying. I think, like, it's admirable that we're all just trying to figure out, you know, these new rules for time and delivery method and how, like, short is an attention span. Like, are all these completely artificial you know, a story should be 25 minutes or an hour. Like, are they fake? Like, do we care about them going forward we have more delivery methods?
We can take War and Peace and serialize it on Twitter, but it doesn't really mean that that's great Twitter literature. And I think that's my thing with like taking some of the breakdown to, you know, 15 second chunks like that. I'm excited, like Brian said, I'm excited about the idea of when somebody says, let me write a 15 second mini short story, movie, animation, or whatever. What will that be? I can't imagine there being a whole lot of entertaining things that people can do there. And that's where I think I may be surprised.
Yeah.
I'm shocked at how much the Vine like comedy community has kind of flourished. Like, there are people who presumably make their, you know, a portion of their living that just do silly Vine comedy things. Like, they just write 6 second jokes and setups and premises and everything. And it's kind of amazing that it has blossomed the way it has. 'Cause it's something that pre Vine, I would not have thought, like, it just would seem like the dumbest possible idea in the world to me.
Yeah, I totally agree.
But that brings back to my question, though. Like, I mean, how has Vine been doing, though? You know, I mean, I've seen statistics that show that it's, you know, viewership is just, they had a peak and then they've fallen apart. It's just because it becomes repetitive. I barely go to Vine because I watch people doing the same thing over and over and over again. And
keep in mind, I think to Justin's point, whether or not Vine survives, certainly the Vine experiment, the art form of the 6 second vignette has certainly thrived and survived because you're seeing these get in, get out 6 second bits on YouTube now. It's migrated over.
Tim.
All right.
Your point would be because, like, it has declined, that it is something that we have seen and rejected? Or,
well, we've always had short form. I mean, there's always been short form. There's always been super short form and interstitials. There's always been that. There's always been that sort of thing. And then my thinking is that, like, I was super fascinated by the Vine platform when that launched. Super, super, you know, fascinated by Vine. You know, what's this going to be? Is this going to be the Twitter of video? Is it going to be like that? And I just threw you guys a graph that shows, you know, what's happened with Vine.
Yeah,
you know.
I'm trying to get it over on the screen right now. But you could see a giant upswing.
Where did you send that, Andrew?
He posted it in the chat. Here, I'll post it on the thing for you as well.
And that doesn't mean, like, I think short form, like, I think short form has a big future. It has all that. And I think the decline of one medium for it doesn't mean that it's not, you know, at all. I'm curious to see, because, like, Cartoon Network going slightly longer form, 15 seconds, et cetera. Is curious to me.
Well, and this isn't a precipitous drop. It does look like, certainly over the last 2 months, you see the beginning of what will likely be either a downward
decline. That's not the right website, Brian. I screwed it up.
Oh, Vine, you did?
That has nothing to do with Vine. That's Vine some grocery. My apologies.
Oh, Vine.com. Aha! Now I feel better.
Let me try it. Yeah, so we'll see. Sure, I've seen another graph, but let me go to Vine.com.
But no, let's go ahead and cape up for Vine.com, though. Let's go ahead and find Vine.com.
All right. So here, let me go to the – I'll send you the actual Vine for Vine video. So it's
there it is. Okay.
It's pretty much – it's roughly the same. And the problem is you had a decline, and now you had a drop, and then you have a it's not a growth medium.
I don't know. Looks fairly level at 4 million uniques per month.
Brian, for the internet, that's not growing.
I mean, that's flat, but still, that's I mean, you're right. It's flat at 4 million uniques. I'd be all right with 4 million uniques.
Well, I want you to be my venture capitalist. I'll be happy to show you the growth metrics of Twitter and YouTube and things that took on. And this is a thing where you've reached almost a year ago. You're almost at the same level of engagement from almost a year ago.
Yeah. All right.
So again, not to say, again, I think short form's got a lot of potential and all that. So I'm just curious. I just don't know. Like, YouTube took off because YouTube became its own kind of culture. And the discovery process, and YouTube, I mean, YouTube is just like, I'm still, you know, we've talked about this on our other podcast, the Creative Podcast, about, as far as, like, trying to become a star or become famous outside of traditional media, the only model I can really think of where you can say there have been multiple people who've done that has been via YouTube.
Yeah, you know? I'd say that's right. YouTube is certainly as ubiquitous and as big as any major network has ever been.
And it is fascinating too, because you know, you talk about YouTube stars that are getting billions of views, and how amazing it is, how most people you talk to will have no idea who they are, which tells you what it means when you have a global audience or people in a very specific niche.
Yeah, well, and I'll tell you what, it certainly affects the way those YouTube stars are able to monetize. One of the things you figure out real fast is when half of all of your fans live on the other side of the globe, you don't want to ship physical objects to them because that is a pain in the butt and costs too much. But if you make digital goods that you're able to sell or set up donation platforms and stuff, I mean, it's just fascinating to see. Again, this is more of the virtualization of the way life was lived 50 years ago, right? Instead of physical things to send out, you have virtual things.
Yeah, virtual hugs. I'm going to hug you guys because it's time for our picks.
Yeah. Who wants to go first?
I will go first, and it's going to be one of those picks that's going to be like, I tell you, I really like this, but. And the but has nothing to do with the quality of it. It has to do more to do with my failings as a human being, okay? And that is – so I try to listen to audiobooks, but I have a problem. I kind of tend to fall asleep during audiobooks. And even the most riveting, really well-done audiobooks I can fall asleep in, and I can't quite make my way through. Mm-hmm. And I asked Morty the fact that – and I don't do this while I'm driving. Let me point that out. this is when I go to bed at night. I'm like, oh, maybe after my eyes are too tired for TV, I will choose to listen to an audiobook, which might be why I'm falling asleep. Yeah. Not sure about it.
Maybe there might be – but then again, correlation is not causality. You never know.
So I am going to right now and say that, like, okay, I picked this up a while ago and I got like probably an hour or so into it and I forgot where I went because I knew that I slept past important parts. So I started the whole thing over. But it's a Star Wars narwhal. It's a new thing. It's a cross between a novel and a narwhal.
It's a Star Wars narwhal.
He's got like a lightsaber instead of that one tusk
exactly
coming out.
It is.
He can cut through anything.
He just cuts right through the ice. That's really an awesome idea, by the way. It's Star Wars Allegiance, written by Timothy Zahn, who wrote the fantastic Heir to the Empire, which I would say is probably the best Star Wars stories outside of the original trilogy.
Absolutely.
And so Timothy Zahn wrote this again, and Timothy Zahn had written some other sci-fi I love, but the part of the plot is about sort of this renegade group of stormtroopers who decide to kind of get on, you know, say, you know what, the Empire kind of sucks. But what stand out for me is, again, I've only made this like maybe 45 minutes into it. I probably spent 3 hours listening to it, but I've just been at the wrong time to try to listen to it, is the performance by Mark Thompson, who is the narrator for it.
Now, did he do the new versions of the Heir to the Empire one?
Yep.
He's so good,
yeah.
Isn't he?
No, yeah, his versions of all of the characters, it sounds exactly like all of them. His Han Solo's dead on.
You're listening to it, and they do some really nice little production value in there where they've added in, you know, some sound effects and stuff. I feel like I'm in the Star Wars universe. And then, like, I wasn't prepared for, like, it picks up, and all of a sudden he does his Han Solo voice. And I'm like, that's a great Han. That's a great thing. And so his voices are really good, you know, and his Han's really – it's Lucas okay, but still, no, he's – does a really good job of that. So he's come in and done these new versions of the stuff. But I've been listening to Allegiance so far. And
actually, can I go ahead? And this is the kind of thing you do during an Audible ad. But you want to play like a tidbit
of
it here?
That's a great. We have the technology.
Where's oh man, I'm looking for a sample. I'm not seeing it.
It's
here.
Right below the book.
There we go. Sample. Here we go. Listen.
Chapter 1.
See.
The Imperial Star Destroyer Reprisal slipped silently through the blackness of space, preparing itself for action against the rebel forces threatening to tear the galaxy apart. Standing on the command walkway, his hands clasped behind him, Captain Kendall Ozzel.
All right, dude, we're just going to get sucked into it. But I love the way they do the setting with the background starship noises and so on.
It's so good. And there's just one of those amazing feelings, like when you feel like the score kind of rise up behind the action at times. Like it's just, it's like the way that they have done these Star Wars novels is amazing. And two, your compliments, which I totally pile on for the reader of it. I love that his readings, like, they aren't necessarily just straight celebrity impressions. Like, it almost feels like his Han Solo isn't exactly Harrison Ford, but it is so true to the idea of the character that it almost feels like it's its own thing. It's not just kind of doing
Han, not Indiana Jones.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And what's funny is there are moments of whenever there's a Wookiee talking, I always wonder exactly how they decided, because there are times in the books where they'll just write RRROOOWRRRRWWWRRRR, but instead, you know, they just play the Wookiee growling sound effect that matches to it. So it gets closer to an audio drama than you would expect.
That's pretty.
I didn't know that he had put out a new one. I didn't know that Allegiance was out. In fact, I'm gonna buy it right now, this very minute.
And you know about was it The Honor Among Thieves?
Scoundrels, the Star Wars Scoundrels.
Yeah, the follow up to Zahn's with Honor Among Thieves.
No, wait, what? What is this one?
So, Empire and Rebellion, Honor Among Thieves. That's written by James S. A. Corey, who did Leviathan Wakes.
Okay,
which is the writing team. Which is big thing. And I also got Mark Thompson doing that. Like, so I think I have that on audiobook, and I think I started it and I didn't finish it. Again, this is not about the quality of audiobooks. It's about my short attention span and my sleep habits.
Well, as long as you're in there, man, it's like, I loved it. It's funny, 'cause like in the 90s, there was a brief period of time where you could say, not ironically, "Hey man, remember Star Wars?" And they're like, "Oh yeah." You know, 'cause it had been 15 years since the last one had come out, and there, you hadn't heard any rumors of them re-releasing and milking and destroying your childhood. But during that time, it was like this golden age when you got all these really high quality science fiction authors writing these anthologies where they would make up backstories for all of the different bounty hunters, or, you know, Tales from Jabba's Palace, Tales from the Cantina, and of course Timothy Zahn's work. In many ways, you know, especially part of it for me has to be the audiobook format. It has me really excited to kind of rekindle that expanded universe feeling again.
My experience, the internet for me used to be Starlog magazine,
mm-hmm.
which I would go to the library and pick up the Starlog and always try to look for any mention of Star Wars, anything new. And then it would, you know, when the Zahn novels came out, there was such this need for it, and went crazy. Just side note, Skeptic magazine, or Skeptic Online, they just published an essay I wrote years ago. We'll say this came out before the prequels came out. And in it, I took a religious argument for, you know, why people, you know, should believe in a particular deity, and I applied it to why you should believe in Yoda.
Oh, that's great.
And so it's called The Case for Yoda. And I think if you go to
here it is right here. Just found it. The Case for Yoda.
I took there. So there was an article called The Case for God, and I did it as just pretty much a point for point response to that. Based upon, well, if you accept that argument, then we kind of have to accept that Yoda is real. Because he mentioned, like, George Washington surviving as being proof of, like, divine influence. And I used George Lucas's car wreck as an example that almost killed him, and we never would have gotten Star Wars, etc. So
where's the – I'm looking for the thing to click to actually see the article here. Here it is. There, yeah. Down.
You're just scrolling down.
Yeah, sorry. This is my weakness. I can't scroll. Man, this is great. You want to read a bit of it down there, or just let everyone?
I wrote that a long time ago.
Go to skeptic.com, and right there on the front page, or if you just search skeptic.com and search for Andrew, they have it listed under Andrew Harder, right?
Yeah. They say formerly Harder. I still have that name.
Yeah. That's funny. Right on, man. What about you, Justin? What do you got?
So back in, let's say, the early aughts, you guys have this experience where you really got excited about, like, on demand on cable when they first started listing stuff?
Yeah.
And it was like DVR and on demand was like the hottest technology, and you're just like,
Can I interject for a moment too?
Oh, what's funny is I thought you were doing an impression of what on-demand services looked like as they started to run and then freeze and then kind of barely advance.
But going from like the period when like, cause like we both started like, you know, VHS, when we first started having money discretion, we first started, we both, all of us probably started buying some VHS tapes and then DVDs. Yeah. And we're just getting the idea of buying and owning stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then on demand comes on. It's like, it's mind blowing. It's mind blowing. Go ahead.
Oh, that was like, especially because it's like, you don't have to wait for the DVD. You know, you can just, or like take a leap of faith on like, oh man, I heard that my friend said that, you know, this was awesome and now I got to buy the DVD for it. But instead, here's this on-demand stuff. And I like, it was like, I would evangelize. I would go to all my friends and be like, no, but it's free. Look, you can just watch the episode. You don't have to be there. And if you don't DVR it, it doesn't matter because they'll just have it up there like the next day. This is amazing. So for, as you know, media kind of moves on and everything, I kind of stopped like using on demand. And I just went back to watch a show realizing that I was like about to buy it on iTunes. And I'm like, oh man, I bet you this is on demand. This is going to be great. So I went back and watched, and it was like going back to an old neighborhood and finding it just spray painted and like crime ridden. And it's, on demand is such a weird experience now that like, it's like, all right, we're afraid of all these other stuff. So let's just cripple this one experience that people really like. Cause like, I was even cool with like them putting ads in an on demand thing.
Yeah.
Like that was pretty rad. Fine. I can, you know, fast forward the ads, but at least I know that they're there and you can put them in weird places, whatever. But when I was watching, my pick is Archer, the new season of Archer, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really just me bitching about the fact that you can't fast forward on Comcast On Demand.
Really?
You watch halfway through and then you fall asleep because this is apparently the theme of today's pick section, are things we love but fall asleep while watching or listening to. And then like I go back the next day and I'm like, oh, okay, well, let me just fast forward. Nope. Because they really want me to know about the Dairy Queen $5 lunch. They need to make sure that I watch through at actual time everything up to the point that I fell asleep at.
That sucks. You know, after the first episode, I bought, because we don't have cable, I went ahead and just bought on Amazon the new season of Archer. So I paid for it in advance. So now it just unlocks each episode the next morning after each of those. Which is kind of dumb. Well, I guess the only way I would have had on demand would be if I had cable anyway. So I guess in that regard, I come out ahead.
But anyway, about Archer, it's really kind of amazing what they did. If you're not familiar with the premise, it's about this spy agency and hilarity ensues. H. John Benjamin is very, very funny. But they decided to reinvent the entire series this season. Like they have completely taken out the spying conceit and they've replaced it with other stuff, among which is their secretary, who is on the course to become a top country singer. And they have released an album of all of her songs. So you can download an actual album, I guess, companion to this season that I have not yet downloaded because I have enjoyed when the songs have peppered themselves into the episodes. And I don't want to spoil future jokes as they go along. But it's very funny. If you like Archer, then you're obviously going to like the new season. But I'm very excited also to download the Shirlene country album as well.
Do you feel I was of two minds when it happened, and I thought it was great to begin with. But that epic 5 minute long montage of Archer's vision for what it would be to be a drug cartel or whatever, which when it happened, I thought this is a massive story. And now it's going to jump us 2 years in the future when they're established and successful. But instead, it just turned out to be like spoilers for everything that was going to happen this season. And I find myself, unfortunately, just waiting for particular moments to come. Like, when does the tiger show up? Oh, this is the episode where they're going to have the tiger. And, you know, here's the episode where that. I'm left feeling like that was a mistake to do it that way. Have you noticed or felt that at all?
No.
All right.
I mean, not really. Like, but that hasn't really bothered me.
But you're watching them all straight through in a row as well. You're not waiting week after week.
I've watched up to before last week's episode.
Yeah, all right.
And then I watched it again because Brett came over and wanted to watch it. So
I saw a trailer last night for a movie, Brian, that was exactly that. Was here's the conflict, here's the problem, here's how he's going to solve it, here's going to be the outcome of that. And it's like, wow. I mean, it's like you talk about things revealing too much. This was the new John Hamm movie, The Million Dollar Arm.
Yeah.
And it's like,
oh yeah.
You're like, I think everything's in this trailer, you know?
Well, at least, and almost always, at least the first act. And it's like, I'm never thrilled to be at the movie theater. Like, to me, the best part of the movie is generally, okay, good. I now honestly have no idea what happens from here on forward. You know, and I understand people who keep themselves pure and don't watch trailers or whatever, because, you know, if you want to get butts in seats, the easiest way is to spoil the whole first act of the movie, you know?
I saw a Captain America one where I'm like, okay, I know this plot point, because if you know the Winter Soldier, you know this, but it's still like, I don't know if they need to just put that right up there in iTunes, you know, watch this, because then you're going to find this thing that might be kind of a cool reveal in the movie.
Yeah. And certainly there were interviews. I know that Robert Redford accidentally said something that spoiled a fairly major plot point to everyone.
Yeah,
but also
I haven't heard that, unless it's just the identity of the Winter Soldier. But I think everybody knows that, but it's still kind of like, you know.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of steering clear of it. But yeah. Awesome. So last time we talked, I told you guys I was rereading Name of the Wind, and I got all the way through the sequel, The Wise Man's Fear. And what's crazy is that my daughter has really fallen in love with the audiobook. She walks around with her iPhone, listening to the whole first book of Name of the Wind. And there are things that happen in the character gets up as far as like 15 years old in The Name of the Wind. But in The Wise Man's Fear, there's like an entire third of the book is about his sexual awakenings and being with women or whatever. And it was really fascinating because knowing that Penelope is really going to want to keep reading this. And there's also like graphic, or I don't even know how graphic it is. There's a moment where basically, you know, he slaughters a bunch of people for just cause at this one moment. And the whole time I'm listening, picturing Penny in the room, and I found myself shocked at how non-explicit all of the sex scenes were. They were explicit in my mind because I'm an adult and I know what he means by a bunch of things. But to somebody who doesn't know, or hasn't experienced and you know, just doesn't know, it really boils down to, all she'll take from it is that there's like naked bodies rubbing on each other and that there's lots of passion. And I'm weirdly okay with her reading it. And so I don't know. It'll be, we'll have to have a discussion beforehand, but I'm finished with that. And so she's catching up behind me. And so now I'm reading Bad Science by, what is his name? I'm going to check on Amazon.
Because, real quick, while you look for that, there is an indelible memory I have that I was watching Pee-wee's Big Top Adventure.
Okay.
And there is a sex scene where it is just a lot of like headboard slamming and then like train going into tunnel, fireworks, like that kind of stuff. I remember my dad coming into the room and yelling at my mom that he was allowing me to watch, or she was allowing me to watch this like filth, and thinking like, well, what's the problem? Like, is a train going into a tunnel and a drill going into that board and there's fireworks? Like, I don't get what the problem is here.
Well, and that's what I suspect it'll be for Penny. I think she'll, I certainly hope so. Maybe I'm a bad dad. But now I'm reading, and again, this is audiobook, Bad Science, Quacks, Hacks, and Big Pharma Flacks by Ben Goldacre. A lot of it is stuff that I had heard before. You know, he rails on homeopathy and some other stuff. But the most fascinating part to me, which is I'm on now, he breaks down all the dirty tricks that Big Pharma is able to do to skew their study one way or another. He basically says stuff like, If 3 months into the trial, if 3 months into your 6 month trial, you're showing statistically significant results, stop immediately, because all that comes next is you have the chance of a regression to the mean, you know, of going of losing that edge. If you're at 6 months and you're not seeing statistically significant results, keep going because you might get lucky. And as you go, is it Goldacre? How do you spell?
Yeah, Ben Goldacre, Goldacre, I think.
Yeah, is that what I said?
Yeah, before you were looking it up, I was thinking it was Golding.
Got it. I thought you just sent that to me like I mispronounced it. Sorry.
No. When you're trying to figure out the name.
Yeah, and he also breaks down the most surprising thing for me is I thought all drug tests used placebos and that was good. You know, you give half them placebos and you give the other half randomized, double-blinded, the actual stuff, and you prove that it's against placebo. He says that those days of that being good research are long gone. We don't care. Nobody should care that your drug works better than placebo. What should matter is, does your drug work better than the best currently available competitor? That's what you should be doing now, or the alternate treatment, which I had never even thought of before. Anyway, really interesting stuff. It's heavier, man. It's a little bit of work to read, but I'm enjoying it. I'm learning a lot.
And I think I haven't read it, but you know, if you think big pharma is scary in the way they do that, your health food industry, your alternative health food industry, is even worse.
Oh, he boils that down. He says that nutritionists, all the entire nutritionist industry, boils down to the most solid evidence they could give is eat your greens, work out, and beyond that, unfortunately, that's not enough to make a career. So you have this entire industry that needs to. Create this essentially like this religion of nutritionism is what he calls it. You know, this idea that, well, this food will fix that and this food will fix that. And he tells the heartbreaking story of people who were refusing in Africa to endorse, you know, using retrovirals or any of these important, you know, traditional therapies, and instead telling them, you know, eat a clove of garlic. It'll keep you younger. And, You can hear you hear the stories of how he sued for libel, because you know obviously the laws in the UK are very permissive. It's easy to you know, take someone to court over that kind of stuff. It's fascinating stuff.
Cool pick. Well, gentlemen, I think those are some interesting picks. Some fun topics, and I guess that's the show.
And then
we generally just cover. Like three topics.
And
how's it been?
Has it been good? I've been good. Been busy. I met my trainer yesterday.
Specifically, the show. How's the show been?
Yeah.
I think it's been whimsical.
You know what?
Why would you say that?
I just say
that was weird. It's been weird.